And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this week Blake McVeigh will be talking to Philip Jett about his true crime book, The Death of an Heir, Adolf Coors III and the Murder That Rocked an American Brewing Dynasty, which is published by St. Martin's Press. In February 1960, Adolf Coors III, known as Ad, was kidnapped on his way to the Coors Brewery in Golden, Colorado, and what followed was a manhunt and a trial that riveted the Mountain West region of America.
Thank you for joining us, Philip.
Pleasure to be here.
You've written this book that is quite extensive about a very famous murder that happened in the 60s, but this is not your first career, correct?
That's correct. I practiced corporate law for 20 years in Nashville.
What led you to write a book of this nature?
You know, it's funny because I have friends who are writers, and I consider them real writers. I view myself as more of a project guy. This story came to me when I was visiting Colorado, and so I kind of treated it like a legal project. I'm like, okay, I want to write this story. I'll outline it and research it and write it and sell it.
So far, so good. It got published, major publisher and everything.
Yeah.
How has it been received so far?
It's been received very well. In Colorado, I was out there for 8 days. We launched it on September 26th. TV, radio, book signings, and everyone was lovely and interested. And many people, even though they live in Colorado, did not recall the story or had not been exposed to it. So they were very excited about it, you know, because the Coors name, you know, in Colorado is king. And for some of them, it was like I had broke on into a historical vault and dusted this story off and given it to them.
So you found it surprising that even though Coors is still such a huge name in the state, that people were totally unfamiliar.
Yeah, and I was shocked. When the story came to me, the first thing I did was go to Amazon.com to see if anyone had written about it. And I couldn't find a book, so I Googled. I did everything I could find. I could not find a book. And I'm like, oh, my God, nobody has written about this. And my research, you know, I found news, contemporaneous newspapers and magazines and that sort of thing, but no one had treated the subject. And I found that amazing, and because, you know, it's, some subjects are just written to death, sort of, in my mind. And this one to have escaped, that was the most surprising thing. And I was thrilled because I'm like, I'm going to make this story mine.
This crime occurred generally the same timeline as In Cold Blood.
Right.
Do you think maybe that's one reason why it wasn't written about in that day and time?
You know, I don't, you know, I've been asked that question, not about In Cold Blood, which, by the way, is one of my favorite books. I've probably read it 3 times in my life. You know, I don't know what that says about me, but because it was a new genre, you know, Truman Capote started that in the 60s with his book. And I'm not sure it was treated that much. It was more like a newspaper article or a news and TV piece. And someone asked me if they thought the Coors family, being so powerful, had put it down. But I saw no evidence of that. I just think it was 1960, and it just wasn't really done back then.
As you were writing, kept In Cold Blood in your mind at all? Do you feel like you took
it? Oh, certainly. When the idea came to me to write this book, I reflected on how I wanted to present it. And, you know, because people have asked me, you chose narrative nonfiction rather than what I call straight nonfiction with footnotes and that sort of thing. And I had the research. I had mountains of research. And so I could have written it either way. And I wanted to write it in a way that was, you know, gets the facts across but presents them in what I view, in my opinion, is a more enjoyable manner. So for me, that's when I looked at this book, I thought of it in Cold Blood, and I said, you know, the one thing I liked about In Cold Blood was how Truman Capote had written short chapters and jumped. Mm-hmm. As soon as you got interested in something, he would jump somewhere else, but he would always keep the story moving forward, but you had to, you know, take a detour. And that's what I try to do with this book. And, you know, it went through some editing and you know, jumbling around, but I tried to stay true to that.
So you talk about how this took you a while to do. Was this something like an idea that you had had years before while you were still working as a lawyer and you just kind of had it in the back of your mind and then eventually you got the time to do it?
No, it's really weird how it came to me. I live in Nashville, but I visit Colorado a couple times a year. I have young sons, although they're in college now. We would go out spring break, and in the summer I would like to go and fly fish and hike. Well, one time I'm out there, and I'm in Golden, Colorado, which is where the Coors Brewery is, and I took the tour. And if you've ever taken the tour, it's an amazing facility. And at the end of the tour, you get free beer. So, you know, I probably went around two or three times, you know. And then on the way out, there's a hallway, and they have all these framed photographs on the wall of Coors and, you know, all the history of Coors and all the family members and facilities. And I noticed that there was one gentleman that disappeared in the timeline when his brothers continued on, and that was Ad Coors III. And it just struck me, and so I was staying at the Golden Hotel, and I immediately went back and Googled him to see if he was suddenly a black sheep or what happened to the guy. And then I saw the story. And so that's when the story came to me, just by chance looking at photos on a wall.
So I find it interesting that you referenced this several times in the book itself, that it sounds like from your description of the hallway where you noticed, you know, Ad Coors at a certain point just kind of disappeared, it sounds like there was no explicit mention of even his death. Let alone the murder or any of the controversy. And that sort of ethic was repeated several times in your work, that the Coors family was very businesslike and close to the vest and really almost insular.
Yeah, they're a very private family, and I think they still are, particularly back then. I mean, this was third generation. Adolf Coors III was the grandson of the founder, and his father was still alive, Adolf Coors Jr., I think partly their German heritage and also the Western stoicism, you know, that, you know, we're tough people. Because, you know, if a son of mine died or whatever and I had a plant and he was involved, I would have treated it totally differently. But that's because I'm a big wishy-washy kind of guy. But they viewed it as their business and no one else's. And I don't think there's still anything there that represents him and his legacy. And, you know, what happened to him. And what I found writing the book is that's the way they like it.
So you had your desire to write. Mm-hmm. You found your story. So talk about how you began the research and what that process was like. You must have done voluminous research.
Yes. You know, there's another author, Eric Larson, and I had read something he said in answer to a question that was posed to him about did he let his staff do the research, which I found interesting because I'm kind of a one-man show and I'm like a staff, you know, wow. And his answer was, why let someone else have all the fun? And that's what it was for me. I actually enjoyed researching it more than writing it. It took a long time, and luckily I had other things going on in my life. For instance, the FBI report took 3 years to obtain because at first they denied having it. And then they said, okay, it's over at the National Archives. And then you contact the National Archives, and they deny having it. And then they find it. And then they say, well, we have to redact it. And the queue is currently 18 months. And then 18 months turns into 3 years. And I was going ahead and writing the book because I had a lot of information from, you know, I got newspaper clippings from the Denver Post and the Rocky Mountain News. And I had contemporaneous magazine articles and that sort of thing. So I went ahead and started writing. And then the other part of the research was I needed the trial transcript. I thought, you know, it was a big part. It was completely gone. The court had destroyed it in 1980, I believe they said. And then I checked with the DA's office. I checked with the defense attorneys and everybody that I could talk to, and no one had it. And I actually put ads in local papers and in the Colorado Bar Association newsletter. And other than getting a lot of strange responses, I still didn't get the trial transcript. I'd written the book. It was ready to go. I was going to present it to an agent, and I thought, well, I'll Google the trial transcript one last time, and it pops up. And it says it's at the University of Denver Law Library. And so I called the head librarian, and she's like, well, I've never heard that, but we just put our catalog online, so that's why you're seeing it right now. And she called back in a few minutes and said, I found it. It's 1,683 pages, and it's down in the basement. I was like, I had just gotten a Christmas gift, you know. I'm like, oh, I was ready to hop on a plane and fly out. And she copied it for me and sent it to me. So I had the trial transcript. I had excerpts from the newspapers. So I had gone ahead and written that part of the book. But the trial transcript let me fine-tune that and also gave me a better feel of the trial, you know, because I read it from front to back, get a better feeling for what was going on.
So it sounds like, as a lawyer yourself, you were the perfect person to write this book with all of that type of – I mean, that's pretty specific research.
In fact, I did so much research that the Denver Public Library asked me to donate my materials, which I will at some point. But I went out to Colorado a couple of times and interviewed people, and most people were receptive to being interviewed. And most of these people, it's almost like the World War II kind of age group. They were – in fact, they had been in World War II. They were in their 80s. And I interviewed probably about 8 or 10 people, and I think only 2 are still alive. In fact, one gentleman I interviewed, the assistant district attorney, was on his deathbed at the time, and he still wanted to talk to me. So, as I say, I interviewed folks not to get facts necessarily, because I felt like I had facts, but I wanted the intangibles. You know, how it felt. Did you like this person? What did he look like? How did he behave? You know, those kind of things. And they could remember that. They would have been a little iffy on the facts, but I didn't need that. But they could tell me if they disliked the sheriff or, you know, what the killer looked like, you know, and he had cold eyes or how did he behave. And it was those intangibles that I really enjoyed getting from them. And everyone was super nice.
And clearly, after all these decades, the case still had a resonance to them. I mean, he's on his deathbed, and he still really wants to talk about
it.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah, and it's funny because if you read the book, the language is pretty clean. But as I say, the assistant district attorney, I think I say in the book, he had colorful language. He was really – when he had an opinion of someone, you were pretty clear how he felt.
Right. Have you had anybody directly tell you that – interest in this case has increased in the state? Have people of Colorado kind of retaken ownership of this story and the Coors family as a result of this?
They have. Well, you know, a couple things. It has. It's ignited, you know, this interest. And one thing I got when I was out there for 8 days from almost everyone, it was almost as if I had treaded on Colorado territory. It's like they would ask, you know, it's funny when you think about it in this day and age, why would someone from Nashville write about the Coors family? Because that's a Colorado story.
Right.
And I'm like, well,
you're an interloper.
I didn't know I had to be within state lines. You know, I'm in interstate commerce. But that was one thing I got. The reason I got that question was more, it's never been told. And here we have all these writers in Colorado and people, and no one's written about it. Some guy from Nashville writes about it. So, yeah, you know, I got that, and I got a lot of interest. And, you know, I've heard from a couple family members that were not pleased that the book had been written. And I had reached out to them during my research, and they, you know, preferred not to talk or didn't respond. You know, and I can understand that because – even though it's been 60 years almost, it, you know, it's a tragedy for the family. And, you know, I'm sure it still brings some pain, in which, you know, I've extended my apology for that.
Right.
But, you know, it's also history. You know, it's a forgotten piece of history that I feel good that I was able to bring back.
And if I remember correctly, at the end of the book, you talked about one of the brothers is still alive,
or
at least at the writing?
He is. He's still alive, or at least I haven't Googled him lately, but at least within the last month, he's 101. And Bill Coors, that's Ad Coors the III's brother, Bill. All of the Coors lived, you know, into their 80s, and Bill has lived past 100. And I don't know if that's the water, the beer, the air, I don't know, but that family has longevity. And that was one remark I made at the end of the book, that if this had not happened to Ad Coors III, presumably he would have had a long, you know, rich life as well.
You talked a little bit about the impact this had on the family, but according to many of the things I read, things weren't necessarily completely rosy with the family before the murder. And, you know, Mary in particular seemed a bit of an outlier.
That's correct. That's what everyone told me when I was able to find people that knew. Mary, she came from the Grant family, which they in their own right were, wealthy, and her grandfather had been, as I recall, the third governor of the state. And if you go to Denver, it's funny because I was there and you'll see Grant Street and you'll see other, names of, buildings with Grant name on it. So she didn't really need the Coors family. She had her own pedigree. And I think that was part of the issue. I don't know this, but from what I was able to determine, she didn't really tremble every time Adolf Coors Jr. said something. And so I think there was, a lot of friction between the two. You know, the Coors father, Adolf Coors Jr., he was old school, and he liked to rule very strictly and according to his thing. And, he didn't view women as anything other than wives and mothers. You know, Mary, she was well-educated and had traveled extensively and very bright woman. She just didn't fit the mold that he wanted her to be in.
There was a quote from the book, about a third of the way through the book, when the Coors brothers and the father, they're talking to the FBI, and Mary and the mother is also in the room. And when the conversation starts to get a little hairy, the women are asked to go down to the basement where the men can talk.
Right.
And as soon as I read these next words, I'm getting ready to quote to you, I wondered, is there some way where he knew this was a direct quote from the father, or is this something that you extrapolated? And the quote is, he was trying to get some facts from the FBI, and they were kind of hedging a little bit. And so he says, don't try to sugarcoat this like you do for that one in the basement.
Right.
Is that a direct quote that you were?
Okay. That was a liberty of mine.
Okay.
That was not something that I knew that he said. But based on his personality and things I had seen that he did say and his relationship with Mary, I felt that that was a good point to make that statement to show, even in this dire time, he was in control and he was running the show. She was just a wife. She wasn't a Coors. And that was the point I was trying to make with that.
Many of the additions you make like that to me felt very authentic. And it didn't seem to me that as I read through the book that it was very easy to discern what was a factual piece of research that you found in writing somewhere as opposed to what you extrapolated. It seemed pretty seamless.
That's good.
Throughout. And I genuinely did wonder, wow, is this a quote that he found? Or?
Yeah, if Mary had a dream, there's no way I knew what she dreamt and that sort of thing. But a lot of things people think that I may have created, I actually had some basis for it, But someone had given me a review recently and it said, that narrative nonfiction is tricky because, if you just stick to the facts, it becomes too dry.
Right.
And if you take too many liberties, you lose the truth. And they had said that I did a beautiful job balancing the two. And that was my intent. But I could tell if I strayed off course too much. It's like, get back. My view of narrative nonfiction is that as long as I tell an accurate story and stick to the facts and don't change facts, but merely present the facts in a more enjoyable way, then I'm okay. And I tell everyone when I've been speaking, I said, for instance, if I have the FBI report, I'm reading, and the FBI is very meticulous, and they say, these two agents' names, they say where they met, they say what they discovered, what the weather was, everything, sometimes even the temperature. So I could just relay that to the reader in narrative form, but that wouldn't be that interesting, at least in my opinion. So I would prefer to set up a scene with the two agents. I have their names, and I know what they look like because I can look them up. And I have them on the bridge talking and the weather and it's cold and the wind and the sounds. And I present it to the reader that way. And, yeah, I don't know specifically what they said, but I do know that they were there and this is what the evidence was. So, I view that as something that I could do without, altering the truth.
You brought up some very interesting cultural elements, such as between Mary and the Coors father. It seems like there was a lot to be said about women's place in society at that time and how women were treated. I found it very odd in hindsight. Apparently, it was pretty common for the day, but I found it very odd that here you have this woman who does not know where her husband is. It does not look good. They leave her alone in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And they fill her full of tranquilizers and alcohol. And for anyone to ever at any point in history think that that would be a good idea is just baffling to me. But I know that's a very late 20th century, early 21st century sort of a thought for me to have.
One thing I got from facts and also interviews was the Coors wives, you know, that's the way they were. They were treated. And they were very intelligent and well-educated and, you know, could have done a lot on their own, but that was just not the time. Like Mary and Ed Coors had married in 1940, and, you know, she raised, you know, birthed four children and raised them, and she just took a back seat to her husband. And, you know, she was involved in society and clubs. And, you know, it was the kind of what we, if you see an old movie from that time period, that's kind of what you see.
It seems like some of the methods that were used, it seems like there was some advances in forensic science that were pretty new for the time. And the thing in particular that I'm thinking about is all of the residue that was taken from the bottom of the
car.
Yeah,
that's pretty cool.
That was found
it?
In New Jersey. So was that cutting edge forensic science?
It was new, and that's why it was so unique. When he burned the vehicle, first of all, that wasn't a very smart thing to do for a number of reasons. But the last thing he would have thought, and he was a very smart guy, was that they'd be taking scrapings from underneath the car and the fenders to build up a case about where that vehicle had been. You know, if it had been, you know, around Turkey Creek Bridge, which is where the kidnapping and murder occurred, and, you know, Pikes Peak is where he dumped the body, and they were able to go back. And it's funny because I did have a statement from a FBI agent who said, and then where the quote, when they sent the samples to the FBI lab, they sent, it was over 457 or whatever. And, you know, the first thing they said was, please don't send any more samples. Well, that came from the FBI agent. He said they actually said that, which I found was funny. So, yeah, that was cutting edge. And that was one of the pieces of the puzzle. Because this case, there was no direct evidence. You know, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. It was all circumstantial. And even the circumstantial evidence taken alone, if you took one piece, it was weak. Because I viewed it as an attorney. I'm like, you know, that's a very weak piece of evidence just because the paper is similar to the paper. But, you know, they didn't have a gun. They didn't have a bullet. They didn't have a typewriter that matched. They didn't have the paper that matched. They, they only had that he made purchases, and he resembled the person that made the purchase. In itself, very weak. But when collectively you take the evidence, it built a pretty strong case. Although, as you'll see, you know, at the end of the book, the jury took 12 ballots, and the first one was almost even.
Right.
So it wasn't a slam dunk.
I found that aspect of it very interesting because it really brought for me the big contrast between reasonable doubt and guilt.
Right, right. Yeah, and it just depends on the makeup of the jury, you know, and a different jury may have found differently, you know, or someone, you know, one juror is all it takes.
Right.
You know, as you'll see from the vote count, it got down to one person held out, and I'm sure they browbeat this person.
Right.
And it's like, you know, it could have gone either way. And in fact, Joe Corbett, the killer, said that later, you know, this was not an open and shut case. It could have gone. And when I was researching it, being an attorney, I was like, you know, I could see an acquittal on this.
Even though I knew, you know, I had looked at the pictures which were in the middle of the book, so I knew that he had been convicted and that he had gone to prison and things like that. But even as I got toward the end of the book, I don't know, I just had some doubt in my own mind as to whether or not he was going to be convicted.
I'm glad that you did, you know, because that's what I tried to portray, because it was a very real thing. And, you know, unfortunately, part of me wanted to write the book as a mystery. The first draft of the book, I did put some mystery in it. I had Joe Corbett as one of the suspects, but I also had this guy named Walter Osborne as a suspect, which was his alias. And I had them doing different things. And so you weren't sure who was who. That didn't make it through the cut, which is good. But what I found was I presented it to a book club. About 25 people read the first draft of the manuscript. What I found was I needed to dump the mystery because a lot of them just went and Googled the story before they read the book. So they knew what happened anyway.
Let's talk about Joe Corbett a little bit. He's an interesting figure because for those who knew about the disappearance and the kidnapping, and they probably viewed some kind of thug, some kind of monster.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Corbett was the opposite of that in at least most of the apparent ways.
Right. I think what he manifested from an exterior and also just from manners. I mean, everyone talked about how courteous he was, from his mm-hmm. landlady to even the defense and prosecutors said he was, you know, courteous. But what I also got from him was he's a very dangerous individual. He was one of those people that, you know, no pun intended, you couldn't judge the book by its cover.
Mm-hmm.
He dressed well. He was well-groomed. He, you know, always kept his clothes pressed and neat and courteous and well-educated, well-spoken. But he was a dangerous person. He had already killed a man when he was 21, and he didn't hesitate to kill Ad Coors. And one thing I got from the defense attorneys and the prosecutor, but particularly from a defense attorney, was that when he told you the story and looked at you, it was just without any emotion. It was just like he was talking about the weather, or, you know, had very cold eyes. So there was something missing with the guy. He was a Fulbright scholar. He had been at the University of Washington. He had been admitted into Berkeley. He was going to be a physician at one point. He had a 148 IQ, you know, not the typical kind of thug mm-hmm. you think about. Even when you see his picture, his photo in the book on the FBI wanted, you know, he looks just like an ordinary kind of guy. And that made it a little tougher for the FBI because he did, you know, he just melted into society. Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that Mary and other people were taken aback by. You want the person to look like a monster and not a nice person, but a monster inside.
He did have some rough family history. His father had been married four times.
And mm-hmm.
He had a foster brother living in the home for a while. It's always speculative to try to consider, you know, did anything like that play a role in?
Yeah, in, you know, and family? I alluded to that at one point. You know, I did enumerate some of the factors growing up, but, you know, who knows? The father and his stepson, they never committed a murder. And, you know, so who knows where the wiring goes wrong. But, yeah, there were some strange things. And, you know, the father drank a lot and, you know, four marriages. And there was a lot of death. I was amazed at the number of deaths from auto accidents. I think there were two, maybe three. And the other thing I really wondered about was the mother's death.
Right.
You know, I bring that up in the book because I felt that he may have killed his mother. There was certainly a possibility, but then again, you know, there was nothing to prove that. But just the fact, I make the statement where he was talking with the FBI agent when he was being extradited, and he was talking about he felt guilty because his mother had fallen and he didn't repair a banister, and he'd always had a guilt complex, and his father and his stepbrother didn't do anything to help him deal with that. But then he went ahead and said something that I found very interesting, which was, you know, it's not that uncommon for children to want to kill their parents. And then he says, but I didn't kill my mother. And I'm thinking, why would he feel the need to say that?
He was an odd person.
You know, he fit the mold. It's so funny, you know, when someone commits a crime, the neighbors are always like, he always seemed like a nice guy, quiet, stuck to himself, blah, blah, blah. That was exactly what he did.
Did you come across any reference to like a psych eval or anybody making anything resembling like a mental status?
No. I quoted the two, maybe three psychiatrist reports that were done in prison. That was the most I could find. And I think they said he was markedly schizoid was one of the phrases. When you read it, he was certainly on the verge of schizophrenia. And, you know, he could have been a psychopath, was bordering on that as well. But no, nothing. They would just say that he was repressing emotion. And so when the emotion did surface, it would be explosive. And I think that's what happened with his two murders. But, you know, you have to remember, when he was released from prison, he lived another 30 plus years. And as far as we know, he didn't kill anyone else.
Except himself.
Except himself. That's exactly right. He, as I said, he was his third victim. And, you know, and I make the point in the book as well, not that I ever felt sorry for the murderer, my sympathy laid with the Corbett family. But when you saw this kid, Joe Corbett, he certainly had a bright future ahead of him. He was a smart guy. He was in college. And you have to remember the time period, and I make this point, there weren't a lot of men in college when he was young, you know, 40s. And he was, you know, in college, and he was a smart guy, Fulbright scholar, high IQ, wanted to be a doctor.
Right.
And if he kept on that path, he would have had a nice life.
Right.
But, you know, that's why I viewed him as a victim of himself. You know, an angel and a devil on his shoulder, you know, the devil won out.
And yet there were times, you alluded to this a couple of times, where he kind of would inexplicably make just an abysmal decision, at least from his standpoint, you know, disposing of his car in a clumsy way or something along those lines. And he made several just clumsy, bad decisions that don't really seem to jive with a man of high intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah. And I made that point in my author's notes at the end of the book. That's one of the things that stood out to me. Very bright individual, no doubt about it. And he planned this for a long time. 2.5 years is what I was able to determine. So you would think, bright guy, 2.5 years to think about it and think about all the possibilities. What could go wrong? What would I do if this went wrong? You know, kind of thing. But it looks almost as if he didn't anticipate that anything would go wrong, mm-hmm. that his plan would go, you know, smoothly, flawlessly. And maybe that says something about his ego, thinking that nothing would go wrong. So it's clear that once something did go wrong, as it did here, tragically, he floundered. You know, he totally floundered. He lost his nerve, and he started doing stupid things. It was almost as if he had given up, and he didn't want to be caught. But he didn't seem to be doing things that made it more difficult to get
right.
caught. He made it actually easy to get caught. He didn't change his appearance. He didn't change his alias. He burns a car in a different part of the country, so now everyone knows he's not in the Denver area anymore, and that sort of thing. So I don't know what was going on with him. I got the feeling, based on everything I read, that it was almost as if he had just said, you know, I'm probably going to get caught, but, you know, I'm going to enjoy myself. He made the statement in the FBI report that he just wanted to have a few final stakes,
right.
you know. I'm like, okay, well, maybe that was the mentality.
That was one of the points at which he received, at least on a minor level, he received somewhat of a comeuppance, because when he said that, the agent referred to how at that same time he was trying to find a ship to Australia.
Yeah, he was, you know, I mean, you know, the guy's clearly a liar and a murderer and a liar. And, you know, he was boastful and all those things. But yeah, he... was kind of like, well, you caught me, but I was going to give myself up anyway, you know, kind of thing. So you didn't really do anything. And the agent made it clear to him that we know better.
So it sounds like a classic case of just thinking that you're smarter than you really are.
Oh, most definitely. And it's funny because I talked to a police detective many years ago, and the police detective said, you know, criminals commit crime, particularly a murder, they usually just once. And even if they plan the murder, they've done it once. He said, but I'm a detective. I do this every day, and I've seen all the ways that you can commit a murder. So this is my business. And so even though they think they're smarter than I am, they've only done this once, and I've seen it many times.
So this murder and the aftermath, you know, Mary, Ad's wife, she took it harder than anyone, it seems. And the rift between her and Ad's father in particular just grew to the point where he cut her out of the will.
Yes.
Were the children also cut out of the will, or was it just Mary?
Yes. I was told that the children were cut out as well. And I was able to get one document which showed that, yes, the kids did not take under Adolph Coors Jr.'s will. What I could not find were trust documents, because a lot of times trust documents are private
right.
and they don't have to be filed with the court. So I didn't want to say 100% that they had been, but I was told they had been. You know, I think in my author's notes, I was a little wishy-washy about that. But from what I do know, this murder of Adolph the III redirected the control of the company. It took it out of Adolf III's family unit, which they would have moved up, Adolf IV, presumably, and on. You know, that was the way they had done. And Bill Kors, we were talking about, who's 101, at that time didn't have any male sons that could step in. Joe Kors, Agatha III's brother, had five sons and no daughters. One was already 18. And so that, in fact, was the group that took over. And Pete Kors is one of those Joe's sons, and he's still in control today as president. And not only did these children of Agatha III suffer the loss of their father, they lost perhaps their birthright, if you want to say that. They lost the trajectory they were on that the Kors family had followed previously.
So it seems like even more so than the Kors family name, the family was more dedicated to, you know, this monolith that was the Kors company.
Yes. And, you know, I stayed out of politics when I wrote this book. And most people are aware that the Kors family is conservative and involved in the Republican Party and that sort of thing. If you step back and take politics out of it and you think about, okay, what if my great-great-grandfather had come to this country from Germany with nothing and gone out to Colorado and started a beer company and made a success and then passes it down to his older son, Adolf Jr., and he continues and survives through Prohibition, which was an amazing thing. A lot of beer companies did not. And so, that, you know, by the time, let's say, you're the grandson, there has to be a sense of pride and a sense of duty. You know, you want to be a steward for this company that is, you know, an American success story, capitalism at its best, sort of. I think that continues. I have friends who have companies and they were passed down from grandfather to son. And, you know, they're proud, just on a smaller level. And I would think you do have a sense of responsibility.
When you think about the case itself, the murder trial, how do you feel, as an attorney yourself, that each side presented their case? Do you feel like there were major mistakes made by either side?
No, you know, I think the prosecution did a very good job. I think the defense, they didn't really have anything to fight. I think they knew. I don't know if they were told. I don't think they were told that I committed the crime. You know, I don't think Joe Corbett said I committed the crime. But he could not give them anything to exonerate himself.
Right, no alibi.
Yeah, he had nothing. So they didn't have anything to work with. And in fact, I asked Ron Hardesty, who was the district attorney at the time and prosecuted the case, I said, you know, why didn't they come up with any evidence? Why didn't they present anything? Because they just relied on closing arguments and they would cross-examine them. He said, well, they didn't have anything. They didn't have any evidence. So even he said there was nothing for them to do. So I think that the defense kept hammering circumstantial, 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 and, you know, just hoping that one juror would hold out. But they didn't have any ammunition to fight with, and I thought the DA presented a very good case.
Do you feel like their strategy of just trying to make one juror be the lone holdout, was that a solid strategy? Is that something that works?
You know, I don't know if they were looking for just one. You know, when the first vote was taken, there were a few holdouts.
Right.
You know, they just didn't have any evidence. So what you do in that situation, and I wasn't a criminal attorney, I was corporate, but, you know, you rely on procedure. You try to, you know, keep things out of the case. You cross-examine witnesses and you try to make them look confused or that they have some motive other than telling the truth. And so you pick apart, you know, and we've seen that on TV in famous cases. And then, you know, at the end of the trial, you make a closing argument and you try to appeal to the jurors and say, you know, this case, there, you know, there is no direct evidence. You know, they don't have a gun, they don't have a bullet, they don't have a typewriter, you know, and he goes through the list. So if you're a juror, you're thinking, you know, just as you were saying, as you were reading along, you know, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. So if you have a doubt and you then you think, well, is my doubt reasonable? And, you know, that's, I could see that going that way. So I thought it was a solid strategy.
I found myself several times during that portion of the book being happy that I was not on that jury because you're right, the circumstantial evidence was heavy. I mean, it really does seem like he did it.
Right.
And yet the defense was not wrong. There was There was no one single solitary piece of evidence that just said, oh, that's it. That is absolutely it. He's guilty.
I know, because it's a heavy burden. When you look at the evidence, you could say, yeah, it looks like he did it. You know, it sure does. Who else would it be? But nobody saw him. Nobody mm-hmm. saw him dump the body. There's no direct tie to this individual. No blood, no nothing. No finger, nothing. You know, it's just people saw him buying this typewriter, or someone saw him doing this, and someone, and then you put the pieces together, and yeah, it sure looks like he did it. But that's not necessarily proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I could have seen a juror saying, I just can't do it. I can't imagine being that juror. This is a mm-hmm. Coors murder trial.
Right.
And you're living in the area.
It would have to come out at some point.
Oh, my gosh.
The tension being discussed right now is what, for me, well, not the thing, but one of the many things that made this such an enjoyable, engaging read is just that it filled my head with a lot of other questions.
Right. Yeah, I think during the trial portion of the book, I wanted the reader to feel that. And I wanted the reader to feel, you know, when Mary took the stand, that you're a juror and you're listening to her mm-hmm. and you feel sorry for her. And then you, like, look over at the defendant. And, of course, they were always reading the ransom note over and over. And they were always passing around the clothes, the bloody clothes, and, you know, all that sort of thing. I mean, things that you might consider prejudicial and certainly would object to, you know, they continued over and over. So, yeah, there was certainly a lot of, you know, tension in the courtroom.
As we draw our talk to a close, I just can't help myself but ask, in your professional opinion, with all the research that you did, do you feel by now that Joe Corbett absolutely was the murderer? Do you have any doubt?
I don't have any doubt. I don't have a doubt. My only concern, and maybe not a concern, the thing that was left open was there someone else?
Right.
You know, because sometimes people would say there was another person in the car, you know, kind of thing. And the one individual I do discuss, he passed a lie detector test, and mm-hmm. it's clear that he was not involved. He may have known about it. I don't know. But to answer your question, I have no doubt based on everything that I read and researched. And, I mean, if he didn't do it, he was certainly the most unlucky guy.
Right.
But, you know, they had partial license plate number, the mm-hmm. fact that he absconded and just covered his trail. And it's pretty clear, you know, based on his covering up that – he
right.
was guilty. And I asked the district attorney this question. I'm like, you know, you guys never found that other car, and there was another individual, and he just blew it off. Like, well, we didn't need it, you know. And he was comfortable in his mind that he got the killer, and, you know, the other car just ended up in the bottom of a lake or somewhere.
As far as a possible accomplice for Corbett, did you include everything in the book that you found in your research?
I did. There was no one else out there, you know, that I was able to find, a coworker or anyone. And that was a mystery to me because I know the FBI, you know, I read a 700-page FBI report.
Right.
And I talked to, you know, people who were still living. And no, I mean, they did not find any evidence of who that could have been. And some of them resorted to, well, the witness was just mistaken. You know, there wasn't anyone in the car. It was just him, kind of thing. So, you know, that's a mystery. So if there is a mystery to the book, that's the mystery. But no, I found nothing, absolutely nothing, that would indicate who that person might have been. And if they were in the car, even if they knew what was going on, maybe they're just taking a ride and he didn't tell them what they were doing. You know, I don't know.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for your time. It was a great read.
Well,
I really enjoyed myself.
I appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Philip Jett is the author of The Death of an Heir, Adolf Coors III, and The Murder That Rocked an American Brewing Dynasty, which is published by St. Martin's Press. Blake McVeigh was your host today. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 800-328-3811 or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.